Hey everyone, just as a quick reminder for those of you who may not have heard, I have joined the Chilling Family, where I'll be providing hours of spine-tingling content and narrations exclusively on the app, and I want to make sure you take advantage of the free trial if you haven't yet. Chilling is the new home of horror and an amazing mobile app that allows you to do things that are just not possible on YouTube, with hundreds of unique and amazing stories that are sorted into curated playlists, or you can create your own. We give you so much flexibility to listen the way you want. This includes a Chilling exclusive feature, our ambient menu. Change the background noise of the story at will to fit your mood, from rainstorms to crackling fires. It's an absolute game changer. Of course, this is offered completely and totally ad-free. That's right, no ads, just hours and hours of uninterrupted, horrifying, creepy, and all-around spooky content. And we're just getting started. Not only are we adding hours of new content every week, but we're soon going to expand into classic novels and audio series. Original video content is also in the works, and we feel we're really building something special here. I couldn't be more excited to have the opportunity to be a part of this journey, and I hope you can join us. Download Chilling now and start your free trial today. Then keep the scares rolling with hours of continually expanded and exclusive content at your fingertips, ad-free, for $2.99 a month. Click the link in the description below or simply search Chilling in the App Store. Also, Chilling is giving away an Xbox Series X as a thank you to all those who have downloaded so far. To win, just download the Chilling app, start the free trial, and then leave your honest review on the app or Play Store. You can check out the Facebook page for more details. It's linked in the description below. Now, enjoy the stories. Born on February 11th of 1860, Karl Denke grew up as the son of a wealthy German farming couple in part of what is now modern-day Poland. Little is known of Karl's early years, but it seems he was a quiet and soft-spoken child who fared poorly in social situations. It's unclear why, but at just 12 years old, a young Karl left his childhood home, never to return. In nearby Munsterberg, he became an apprentice gardener for a while, but after deciding that outdoor work didn't suit him, he quit and worked a variety of odd jobs before receiving a sizable inheritance following his father's death. It was with this inheritance money that Karl purchased his first plot of land, having bizarrely decided to take up farming. As you can imagine, given the amount of outdoor work involved, Karl found that farming didn't suit him either. So he sold his land for considerably less than he paid for it, then continued working odd jobs around Munsterberg whilst living in a small house there. Karl did okay for himself. He was a popular figure in his local community and even played organ down at his local church. As a result of his staunch piety, generosity, and friendly demeanor, Karl was nicknamed Papa Denke by the local townsfolk, and he became something of a surrogate uncle for some of the town's more wayward youth. If you were in need of something to eat, go see Papa Denke. Need a bed for the night? Go see Papa Denke. Late on the rent? You get the idea. By age 66, Karl had become a pillar of the community. Everyone knew his name. Everyone knew his face. There wasn't a soul in Munsterberg that didn't know his rosy red cheeks and wide, warm smile. But the same face that everyone had come to love so much, it was nothing but a mask. A mask Karl wore to hide his true nature. Papa Denke wasn't the man that everyone thought he was, and his mask was about to slip. It was the night of December 21st, 1924, just a few nights before Christmas, and befitting the time of year, Papa Denke's house was seeing increased traffic from the city's most vulnerable people. It was such a good service he provided, what with the streets being so dangerous. More and more of the homeless were going missing every year now, vanishing from the recesses they'd been banished to, never to reappear. Some said the last place their missing friend had been seen was Papa Denke's house. But that made all the sense in the world. He was a charitable man. Many of the homeless darkened his door on a nightly basis. Besides, such a man of faith wouldn't have it in him to hurt anyone, would he? But that same festively frosty December night, A passerby heard something as he walked past Papadenka's house, something that made his blood run cold. It was the cry of a man who knew he was about to die, a kind of blood-curdling mortal lament, the final sound they might ever make. The passerby burst into Denka's house, terrified that the man himself might be under attack from one of the very people he was trying to help. But instead, the passerby quickly encountered a young vagrant, still on his feet for a moment, despite his head just about being cleaved in two. When asked who'd inflicted such a terrible wound, the dying man managed to utter two final words before he expired. Papa Denka. Realizing he had stumbled into the den of a sinister and surreptitious predator, the passerby immediately fled Denka's home, headed straight for the nearest police station. Once Denka had been arrested, a search of his house revealed the hidden identification papers of a dozen missing people, plus various items of male clothing that were so small they could be categorically ruled out as belonging to Denka. But by far the most disturbing and incriminating discovery was to be made in Papa Denka's kitchen. Police located two large vinegar barrels, each containing large chunks of what looked a lot like pork. Denka seemed to be in the process of pickling some gammon for the winter. At least, the police were hoping it was gammon. Yet when they discovered the butchered corpses of up to 30 of Denka's victims, it became clear the Munsterberg police had a cannibal on their hands. What's more, Denka had made the mistake of writing down the names and ages of his victims in a small notebook, along with the dates of their murders and the parts of their corpses he was pickling. The scope and scale of his operation was horrifyingly clear, and it's obvious that the pickling process was intended to allow Denka to savor his victims for months to come. But the questions of what made the man so deranged in the first place, and why he was compelled not to only kill, but consume the bodies of his victims, those police were anxious to answer. Unfortunately, they never got the chance, as Papa Denka would use a secreted handkerchief to hang himself in his cell on the very first night of his arrest. He was obviously deeply ashamed of his actions and was unable to face the backlash and consequence of those. But just how much Denka had to be ashamed of was only revealed after his death. It had turned out that not only had Papa Denka pickled and eaten his poor, vagrant victims, he'd also fed other people their remains. The vast majority of the homeless folk who visited Papa Denka were given small jars of what he called pickled pork, small, highly nutritious chunks of protein that could last Munsterberg's hungry for a considerably long time. But it wasn't pork. It wasn't ever pork. Papa Denka, Munsterberg's happiest, holiest, friendliest citizen, had been feeding the homeless to each other, and had been doing it for years. Needless to say, it wasn't a very merry Christmas that year in Munsterberg, not for those who knew the taste of Papa Denka's pickled pork. Throughout history, Europe has birthed its fair share of fearsome warrior societies, from the warmongering Spartans of ancient Greece, to the mercenary Celts who sold their swords as far afield as Egypt. Many have a right to contest the crown of Europe's finest martial culture. But as history shows, none have been as savage, bloodthirsty, or merciless as the men whose dragon-headed longships pierced the mists off the north shores of Britannia. These were the Northmen, men who worshipped a pantheon of terrifying icons, men who were said to descend into a euphoric trance during battle, men who slaughtered holy Christian monks as if they were nothing but cattle. To those they raided, murdered, and enslaved, they were the Oscamani, the Lochlannik, the Dubgael, and the Fingael. But to each other they were the Danes, the Osmen, the Vikings. As warlike and aggressive as the Vikings were, they weren't simply bloodthirsty savages who eschewed all forms of civilization. In fact, the works of Viking historians are perhaps some of the most extensive and revealing documents produced during the entirety of the first millennium. Known in Old Norse as the Sjarr, the Viking sagas appear to have been written around the year of 1200 AD and combine epic poetry, history, and a dash of legend to form one of history's most fascinating pieces of written documentation. Arguably the most well-known variety of saga is the Íslendingasagur, a rather detailed account of the Viking migration to Iceland and the blood feuds that plague the emigrant families as they attempt to carve out a new life for themselves in the cold and barren steppe. As you can imagine, there are many examples of foul play, murder, and barbarity in the Viking sagas. But the description of one particular slaying stands out among the others, and it details the ambush and killing of Thrain Sigvinsson by Kari Sölmundarson and two sons of Njál Torgerson. Both had sailed to Iceland in two separate expeditions, each gaining a great deal of honor in the process. But a disagreement in their camps led to insults being exchanged, and in response to the disrespect shown by the arrogant Thrain, Kari and the sons of Njál decided to ambush him at an icy river crossing. They waited weeks for Thrain to go on a journey that would involve crossing the thick ice bridge on foot, leaving him extremely vulnerable to attack as he and his party approached the opposite riverbank. Finally, Kari's spies passed on the news that Thrain was on the move, so he and his allies rushed to the ambush site, patiently waiting for their enemy to appear. Slowly but surely, Thrain and his bodyguards came into view and began their careful trek across the ice. It must have been agonizing, watching as your sworn enemies make their way towards you at a painfully slow pace. According to the sagas, the ice bridge crossing wasn't just a few steps across a frozen stream. The river in question is thought to be at least 150 meters wide, so given how slippery and treacherous it would have been, we can be sure that it wouldn't have made for a quick journey. The impatience of Kari and his men must have been stretched to the breaking point, so much so that one might say they were biting their shields in frustration. As it turns out, the term shield-biter was a familiar one to Viking warriors, and it was perhaps a less than respectful nickname for those they called Ufadinar, literally translating as those who wear coats of wolfskin. The Ufadinar did as their name describes, intended to wear nothing but a wolfskin when charging into battle. And I really do mean nothing but a wolfskin, because at a time when most Vikings made the tactically intelligent decision to wear mail and helmets, the Ufadinar eschewed any kind of protection, often taking two one-handed weapons instead of an axe and sword and shield combination. This level of disregard for their own safety struck terror into the hearts of those that faced them. To their enemies, the Ulfhedinar were not soldiers, they were madmen, and the word used to describe their behavior in battle was hamask, which means to change forms. They were men who turned into wolves during battle, the foundation on which the modern werewolf legend could well be built on. Yet despite the Ulfhedinar being terrifying in appearance alone, there was something else at work in them that made them considerably more frightening, something that begins with a rather creepy-looking flower. With its pretty-looking cream and purple petals, you'd be forgiven for thinking the henbane looks rather benign. But henbane had been used as far back as ancient Greece, where it was combined with other plants to create a natural anesthetic potion. It was also known for its psychoactive properties, with some Arabian sources describing the plant as a key ingredient in what was called a magic brew, a phrase which seems to be nothing more than a euphemism for an intoxicant. Such psychoactive properties are said to include visual hallucinations, a feeling that the user is flying, and short-term memory loss. But ingesting henbane can also have another rather distinct effect on the user: sudden and uncontrollable anger. This anger effect can range from agitation to full-blown rage and combativeness depending on the dosage and the individual's mental state, wrote Karsten Fartur, an ethnobotanist at the University of Ljubljana in Slovenia. It was this full-blown rage that led to Viking warriors biting their shields in delirious frustration before finally charging their enemies with a fury unmatched by any before or since. It made for a horrifyingly savage display, and it even unnerved the Ulfhedinar's own comrades, who apparently held them in such contempt that one nickname wasn't even enough for them. Men called them shield-biters, but they also called them bear-shirts, or in Old Norse, berserker. Consider that for a moment. Being attacked by a semi-naked man wearing nothing but wolfskin, and slowly becomes obvious that he's too high to care about dying. In fact, he thinks dying is the best possible outcome for him, second only to killing you and every last one of your friends. Not only that, but the anesthetic effect of the henbane means he can shrug off wounds that would easily fell a sober man. Starting to see why Iron Age Britons feared the Vikings so much? So we have every reason to believe that on the day of ambush, to further enhance their combat prowess, Kari and his men were at least partly under the influence of hallucinogenic drugs. And when they struck, they did so with terrifying ferocity. What follows is without a doubt the most dramatic account of combat in all of Njal's saga, as Kari and his men chase a fleeing Thrain Sigvinson across the ice bridge, slipping and sliding all the way. One of Kari's men surges ahead of his comrades and catches up to Thrain, who turns just in time for the man to bury his axe into the top of his skull. According to the sagas, Thrain's skull was split perfectly in two, from the top of his skull to his jaw, and the man who killed him said he heard Thrain's teeth tinkling on the ice as they fell from his cleaved skull. We can only imagine the steam that rose off the contents of Thrain's skull, hot flesh exposed to the icy air, and how his blood seeped into the ice, melting it slightly before cooling again, so that seeping blood and brain froze, sealing the dead man's skull to the ice. When the battle was over, Kari Sölmundarson had to chip away the frozen gore before removing what remained of Thrain's head from his shoulders. To him, it was a trophy, evidence of an insult avenged. Even by Viking standards, the ambush was widely condemned by Kari's contemporaries as he had chosen to ambush Thrain whilst he was unprepared, rather than face him in open combat. But further violence was avoided when Njal married off one of his daughters to Thrain's brother, whilst adopting one of the dead man's son as his own. According to the sagas, the orphan boy was well cared for, and Njal even went on to grant his foster son both chieftaincy and a wife. Yet the sagas rarely have happy endings, and not only did this orphan boy die in a fire intended to kill Kari Sölmundarson, the man who'd murdered his father, Kari Sölmundarson also goes on to marry the orphan boy's widow. So essentially, throughout the course of his life, Kari takes the father's life, takes the son's life, all before he marries the son's wife. It appears that when the Vikings had blood feuds, there were no half measures, and the amount of justice received was entirely proportionate to the amount of blood you were willing to spill. Nestled amongst the beautifully verdant rolling hills of northern Spain, the sleepy province of Palencia has long been the breadbasket of the region. With the regal sight of Cantabrian mountains on the horizon, visitors to the area can wander along fields of barley, wheat, and sugar beets, maybe even venturing into a small municipality that's famous for its delicious bell peppers, a place known to the locals as Torquemada. Torquemada might well be known for its vegetables, but it's famous for another reason entirely. For on the night of October 14th, 1420, a family of formerly Jewish Christian converts welcomed a son into the world. The boy's uncle Juan was a celebrated theologian and cardinal, and it was expected that the boy might one day follow his uncle into the priesthood. If so, it would rather be fitting if the boy were to be given a biblical name, Tomas, making him Tomas de Torquemada. But the name Tomas de Torquemada was one that would fail to be associated with charity or piety. Instead, the boy's name would become synonymous with unspeakable cruelty, religious intolerance, and blind, violent fanaticism. Tomas was just a boy when he moved to the local San Pablo Dominican monastery to begin his induction into the priesthood. By the time he was a teenager, all he knew was doctrine, orthodoxy, and austerity, having rapidly developed a reputation for rabid religious conformity. As a result, he was promoted to prior of the monastery of Santa Cruz at Segovia. It was around this time that Tomas met the young princess Isabella. From the moment they met, the two immediately established a deep religious and ideological bond, and Tomas served as her regular confessor and personal advisor for a great number of years. By the time he attended Isabella's coronation as queen in 1474, he had the ear and the favor of one of Europe's most powerful monarchs. Yet despite his immense power, there were two groups of people among the Spanish people that Tomas both hated and feared. One was the Moriscos, the other was the Marranos. The Moriscos were former Muslims whom the Spanish crown had forcibly converted to Christianity. Despite his own converso heritage, Tomas viewed the Moriscos with suspicion and contempt, but the majority of his hatred was reserved for the Marranos. These were Iberian Jews who had publicly converted to Christianity, but merely as part of a ruse that would allow them to continue to practice their faith in secret. To Tomas, that was the greatest imaginable affront to God, and it was his opinion that the greatest priority of the church should be to rid Isabella's kingdom of these heretics. On Tomas's advice, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella pleaded with the Pope to grant them an inquisition in which to purify Catholic Spain. And in 1478, a papal bull granted the monarchs free rein to name inquisitors. Naturally, it wasn't long before Tomas himself was named the Grand Inquisitor of Spain. It seems the man's meteoric rise to power was simply unstoppable. In the 15 years that he was in charge, Tomas de Torquemada expanded the Spanish Inquisition from a single tribunal in the southern city of Sevilla to a nationwide operation with more than 20 outposts around the country, including one in every major city. And it was under his leadership that the organization adopted a single, unifying, steadfast objective: to rid Spain of all heresy, once and for all. Spanish historian and contemporary of Tomas, Sebastian de Olmedo, once called him the honor of his order, the hammer of the heretics, the light and savior of all Spain. But this couldn't be further from the truth, and Tomas de Torquemada was about to be presented with an opportunity to prove what a monster he truly was. During Tomas's rise to power, Catholic Spain was engaged with a bloody struggle with the Moors of Al-Andalus. The Islamic Moorish people of North Africa had invaded southern Spain more than 700 years previously via the Straits of Gibraltar. They quickly conquered the province of Roman Hispania, renaming it Al-Andalus, or the Land of the Vandals. During the hundreds of years that followed, the Muslims of southern Spain established one of the most advanced civilizations of the period. The city of Granada still boasts some frankly stunning examples of Moorish architecture, and at a time when Iron Age Britons were still living in huts and painting themselves blue, 9th century Granada had a rudimentary sewer system, public water fountains, and even street lights. What's more, the Umayyad Caliph was so liberal and tolerant of other religions, some historians say that Granada was a Jewish state in all but name. Unlike other regions of the Muslim world at the time, the Jews of Al-Andalus were the ethnic majority, and were therefore not considered foreigners. In fact, many were exempt from the jizya, a religious tax that was normally imposed on non-Muslim residents of Islamic states. According to contemporaries, there was an attitude of convivencia, or coexistence, among the citizens of Al-Andalus. Christians were also allowed to live, work, and start families in the region, just as long as they held a similar level of tolerance and respect. Yet as the native Catholics regrouped in the north and began a rousing resurgence, their ire was focused solely on the heathens in the south. They remembered the conquests of so many years before, and to them, it didn't matter how egalitarian or accepting the Umayyads were. They were, and always would be, infidel invaders. Just as great civilizations rise, so too they must fall, and it wasn't long before the Umayyad Caliphate began to wither and crumble. So began La Reconquista. The native Catholics took advantage of the chaos, taking back more and more of their formerly Christian lands. Thousands of vengeful Christians joined them, and in 1491, they marched on Granada, defeating the multi-faith army of the Umayyads and negotiating the Treaty of Granada. Ratified on November 25, 1491, the treaty guaranteed the religious freedoms of Muslims and Jews in exchange for all lands previously occupied by the Moors. Just 4 months later, Spain's new Christian rulers completely went back on their promises, yet the subject of their hatred would not be the Moorish Muslims, who had mostly fled after their defeat. It would be the Sephardim, the Spanish Jews. Over the years that followed, an estimated 40,000 Jewish people were exiled from Catholic Spain, forced to flee with only what they could carry. However, approximately 50,000 Sephardic Jews were given leave to remain, but only on the condition that they convert to Christianity. Although the ruling was a cruel one, it was at least an attempt at reconciliation. Yet it presented Tomás de Torquemada with a rather unique problem, because if you remember, in spite of his own Jewish background, the viciously overzealous Tomás hated the so-called Marranos with a passion. His hatred and suspicion of them boiled over into a venomous paranoia, and he became fixated on the idea that all of these newly Christian converts were secretly practicing their faith behind closed doors, and as we previously discussed, that induced a burning rage inside of him. Almost overnight, he was faced with 50,000 potential heretics, and every single one of them needed to be questioned before they could carry on living in Christian lands. In the eyes of Tomás, he was faced with a mammoth of unenviable task, but given the celestial rewards involved, he was most definitely up to the task. And so began one of the single most horrifying periods of human history, one in which madness, violence, torture, and death all rode under the guise of a loving and forgiving institution. When the Inquisition first arrived in a town, they'd offer something resembling a grace period. Those who came forward to confess their sins avoided any serious punishment and were simply let off with a small fine. But after the grace period was ended, those who were found to be performing heretical religious rites were publicly shamed. They were paraded through the streets of their town, forced to wear what was called a sanbenito, a kind of yellow robe with a red cross on it, signifying they had sinned against the one true church. One particularly egregious offender, such as rabbis, mullahs, or those who own religious texts, were forced to whip themselves with fine cordage as they were paraded through town. If they didn't whip hard enough, the Inquisition would do it for them, targeting the back of the knees until walking became impossible. If a penitent passed out, they would be flogged continuously until they awoke again to finish their journey. Men were said to be in so much pain after such marches that they lay in bed for days afterward, barely able to move, barely able to speak. However, those who were foolish enough to deny their so-called sins, those who tried to lie their way out of their penitence, they were subjected to the very thing the Inquisition was infamous for: torture. Yet despite being renowned for its methods of inflicting pain, the Inquisition would only subject a person to torture under a strict set of conditions. Firstly, torture was only permitted when sufficient proofs to confirm the culpability of the accused had been gathered by other means, and every other method of negotiation had been tried and exhausted. Or in other words, a prime suspect refuses to admit their guilt. Despite the archaic legalese, the implications are terrifying. Just about anyone can be subject to torture if the inquisitor in question had it in for them. And as you can imagine, just about anyone was tortured under the Spanish Inquisition. Secondly, the Inquisition was prohibited to maim, mutilate, or draw blood from the prisoner, meaning they had to come up with some rather horrifying creative methods of inflicting torment and suffering. Since there were Inquisitions all over Europe, the Catholic Church essentially had a network of professional torturers to draw experience from. And so, some unfortunate priest was tasked with collating a list of bloodless torture methods from all over Christendom. This was then passed on to the Spanish Inquisition, who were then armed with literally hundreds of highly creative and painfully effective methods of extracting information from suspected heretics. There was also the question of how long and how often a suspect could be subjected to these methods of torture, and it was decided that depending on the severity of the accusation, a suspect would be subject to a varying number of torture sessions, with the maximum being 8. Torment, as the inquisitors called it, could only be inflicted for 15 minutes at a time, with a mandatory period of rest afterwards. All in all, the Inquisition tried to design a method of torture that they would call humane and assured all of their victims that a trained physician would be in attendance to ensure they suffered no serious injuries. But in reality, It meant you could be tortured on the hour every hour for 8 solid hours. And the injuries weren't just serious, they were life-changing. One method of torture was known as el estrapado. The hands of the accused would be tied behind their back. These wrist ties would then be attached to a kind of crane, one that would lift the victim into the air by the arms, causing an unbearable amount of pain. Some inquisitors even strapped weights to the victim's feet to cause more resistance and pain, and after a while, their overextended shoulders would separate from their sockets with sickening twin pops. Reports of its effectiveness were widespread, with some inquisitors claiming it produced a confession from even the most stringent deniers in less than an hour. And while Strapedo was incapable of killing its victim, permanent nerve, ligament, and tendon damage was almost unavoidable. Another method managed to turn a basic necessity for life into a means of torture, and even murder, with what was called the water cure. Victims of the water cure were strapped down and had water funneled into their mouths, some say up to 30 pints, that's 600 ounces at a time. This could cause the victim to violently and uncontrollably vomit, denying them breath and sometimes rupturing their digestive tract. Even worse, drinking copious amounts of water in a short period of time can lead to a condition known as hyponatremia, or in layman's terms, water intoxication. It causes sodium levels in the bloodstream to plummet and can lead to a fatal inflammation of the brain. The name of this torture device is entirely self-explanatory. The head crusher. The victim's head was placed in a vise, the victim's chin positioned on top of a metal bar while the upper portion sat atop the victim's skull. To begin the torture, the inquisitor would tighten a screw at the top of the device, slowly crushing the victim's skull. As the skull was compressed, the victim's teeth shattered, and in particularly extreme cases, the victim's eyeballs would pop out of the skull, which most certainly led to infection, disease, and eventually death. But perhaps the most eye-watering horrific method of torture used by the Spanish Inquisition has to be what they called the Cradle of Judas. The Cradle of Judas bears an uncanny resemblance to a regular wooden stool, but with one distinct difference. Instead of a flat wooden seat, it has a sharpened iron pyramid. If you can't see where this one is going, I'll spell it out for you. The accused person was stripped naked, bound at the wrists, then forced to sit atop the sharpened point of the iron pyramid. Inevitably, the steel peak would penetrate the victim somewhere you most definitely do not want to be penetrated. But it gets so much worse. In the same way that inquisitors found a way to enhance the effects of El Estrapado, they found a way to enhance the Cradle of Judas. Using ropes and pulley systems, the sadistic interrogator would force the accused to sink deeper and deeper down into the pyramid. This is yet another example of how some methods of torture both did draw blood and cause death by infection or internal bleeding. In fact, Tomás de Torquemada received so much negative press over his flagrant disregard for the rules that Pope Sixtus had to reprimand him, not once, not twice, but on 3 separate occasions. Yet each time, Isabella and Ferdinand rushed to his defense, saying that Tomas's zealousness was purely due to his love of Christ. And each time, the Pope dropped any disciplinary proceedings against their favorite priest. The only thing that slowed Tomas down was his ailing health, although it appears that this was used as a mere excuse to dilute his power in 1494. With his faith in his mission undiminished, Torquemada retired to the monastery of St. Thomas Aquinas in Avila, returning to the much simpler life of a Franciscan monk. Then, after more than 15 years as Spain's Grand Inquisitor, Torquemada died in the monastery on September 16, 1498. When he finally died, he did so with the blood of literally thousands of people on his hands. He was a man that believed that, on his entry into heaven, he would take his rightful place at God's right hand. But in reality, if there truly is a loving God up there, one who rewards the meek and punishes the wicked, then there isn't a single shred of doubt that Tomás de Torquemada is roasting in hell. All we can hope for is that one of history's most profane and debased murderers is being subjected to the same torture methods suffered by his legions of innocent victims. Picture the scene. It's June of 1462, high summer in Valahia, the southern province of modern-day Romania. You're a soldier in the Imperial Ottoman army of Sultan Mehmed II, part of an invasion force sent to subdue a local lord, one unwise enough to have made an alliance with one of your sultan's enemies. Valahia is a small and insignificant fiefdom, merely a stepping stone on the road to the greater prizes of Budapest and Vienna. Subjugating the locals should make for a quick and easy task, you and your comrades think. The Valachians are backed by a small defensive force. Us Turks have the weight of the empire behind us, not to mention the favor of Allah. But the Valachians prove more tenacious than first expected, and a nighttime ambush of your encampment leaves many dead on both sides. To your horror, you learn that a dedicated squad of Valachian soldiers had attempted to fight their way to the center of the camp, no doubt intending on assassinating the Sultan himself. You and your comrades are furious at such a despicable display of dishonor. To you, such a disgrace must not go unavenged. The Sultan only feeds your anger and bloodlust as he promises an immediate march on the regional capital, a city known as Targoviste. Only, as you gather your things and prepare to depart, you hear the news that the Valachians sent a team of soldiers to butcher as many of the army's horses as possible. As a result, unless you can pillage one on the way, you will be without a trusty mount for the remainder of the invasion. By the time you and your comrades reach Targoviste, you're parched, starving, and utterly exhausted. The entire journey, Valachian archers picked off your brother-in-arms from hidden vantage points. And what's worse, the sickly-looking beggars, minstrels, and ladies of the night you met on the way, they weren't just chance encounters. They were walking biological weapons. The Valachians had rounded up as many walking sufferers of bubonic plague as they could, disguised them, then sent them wandering at your advancing ranks to spread the deadly pox. Over the past few days, men have been dropping like flies. The huge bursting pustules under their armpits invite sepsis and rot. You're terrified, paranoid, and running on empty, but you're still up for the fight. One last push and it will all be over, the sergeants say, and for now, you believe them. You and your brothers have been prepared to storm the defenses of a well-defended city. You have grappling hooks, rudimentary explosives, bladed weapons of varying sizes, and a wealth of experience in plying your blood-soaked trade. You're prepared for any and all eventualities. All except one. For as mounted Ottoman scouts report back to their commanders, word spreads around the camp that the gates of the city have been left wide open. In fact, the entire city is deserted. Not a single Valachian has remained behind to defend their home. It's hard to imagine that a cheer wouldn't have echoed around the camp. Cries of God is great and God save the Sultan erupting from every direction. You've seen too much death already. Too many friends have been lost along the way. A prize taken without a fight was just as valuable. You and your brother's soldiers march toward the city gates, the Sultan and his royal guard at the head of the column. It feels like a victory parade, the beginning of your unstoppable march across Christendom. But little did you know, it's not a victory march. It's a funeral procession. As you watch the first section of troops march through the gates, the first screams rise up from the head of the column. The entire way you can hear more and more of your comrades crying out in horror. You just can't see what they're reacting to. But then, passing through the huge wood and iron gates, you see what horrified them so. And it's an image that will stick with you for whatever time you happen to have left. Bodies. Thousands of them. The main thoroughfare of Targoviste is lined with dead bodies. All are Ottoman soldiers. All your brother soldiers. And they've been killed in one of the slowest and most torturous ways imaginable. Each man has been impaled on an 18-foot wooden stake. And from the looks of things, whoever had done so had made sure to impale them whilst they were still alive. Even more grotesque is the method of impalement, as the dead men have been pierced vertically not horizontally, before being mounted at the side of the road. You walk down the city's main drag for almost 30 minutes, and every inch of it is lined with impaled corpses of your compatriots, 20,000 of them to be exact. Most of you are veterans. Even the relatively new soldiers had been seasoned by the march through southern Valachia. But for some, the sight of what became known as the Forest of the Dead was simply too much to bear. Some of the younger, less hardened troops simply lose their minds there and then and have to be restrained by their comrades. One might expect some of the greenhorns to snap at such a sight, but even the old salts are ashen-faced and shaken. Men are vomiting in the roads beside them. Some are crying. Many are praying. One or two even talk of deserting at the first available opportunity. Remember, it is June, high summer in Valachia, a place where daytime temperatures have been known to reach 112 degrees Fahrenheit. The stench must have been absolutely abominable, a miasma to match an apocalyptic atrocity. Yet on and on you march for mile after mile, breathing in the reek and the rot and the ruin. Once you reach the open country on the other side of Targovishta, the Sultan, obviously shaken by the Forest of the Dead, orders a huge, spike-lined pit to be dug around the camp to prevent the infiltration of the evidently savage Valachians. Few of you sleep that night. Those of you that manage to get some wake up screaming. But even if you did manage to catch some shut-eye, you'd probably only be woken up moments later anyways. The sentries are jumpy that night. They keep seeing ghosts in the distant darkness, phantom Valachians that are mere figments of their imagination, and every time they do so, they raise the alarm. They're scared, just like you are. The following morning, the Sultan orders a tactical withdrawal from the area, citing difficulties in your supply lines. You're not retreating. You've not been defeated, don't worry. You'll sack a small town on the way back to Turkey, grab some loot, grab a few slaves, and call it a victory. No one will talk about the Forest of the Dead, not by order of the Sultan. No one must ever know what a crushing display of cruelty was inflicted on the mighty Ottoman. And all by some small fry Balkan, who just so happened to have an insatiable appetite for abhorrent acts of villainy. But who is this monster anyway? One of your fellow survivors asks. He calls himself the Son of the Dragon, one of the sergeants say. Son of the Dragon? The fear in another survivor's voice is palpable. Aye, his father was a knight of the Order of the Dragon, a Dracul, the sergeant replies. So his son, Vladislav, is of the dragon, you see. That is why they call him Vlad Dracula. Dracula. You might be a lowly Ottoman soldier, but you've heard that name before. And it's only now that you begin to understand why a man might have such burning hatred and evil inside of him. Because this isn't the first time Vlad Dracula has encountered Turks. In fact, he's very familiar with them indeed. You see, a young Vlad had once accompanied his father and young brother on a trip to Gallipoli to meet with the Ottoman Sultan. It turned out the reason for the summit was to secure the loyalty of Vlad's father to the Turkish Sultan. But the ruler of Valachia was struck between a rock and a hard place. He had the Turks on one side, and the comparably powerful Hungarians on the other. If he pledged allegiance to one of them, the other would surely march against him. Vlad's father made a reasonable point, but the Sultan had a better idea. Instead of playing the diplomat, the Sultan simply had Vlad and younger brother thrown into a Turkish prison. If their father's loyalty to the Ottomans wavered, it was heavily implied that the boys would be tortured, executed, and mutilated. It is believed that Vlad spent around 10 to 15 years of his life as a prisoner of the Sultan in the fortress of Ergogos, but not in the sense you might think. He wasn't kept in a cell constantly, not as time went by anyway, and as his behavior improved, so did his standard of living. But his early 20s, Vlad's life was relatively comfortable. He became a kind of illegitimate son of the Sultan, enjoying the freedom of the fortress and the surrounding area. It didn't matter if he ran. After all, where would he run to? He'd be caught within a day. Befitting his fortress prison, Vlad developed a particular interest in the martial arts. He taught himself to fight with a variety of bladed weapons, and since the Turks had some of the finest archers on the planet at the time, he was in no short supply of archery teachers. Vlad also showed an interest in military tactics and spent a lot of his time poring over old military stratagems, studying maps and soaking up dispatches. He was preparing for something, readying himself for the storm that gathered on the horizon. And in November of 1447, it struck. Vlad's father and his older brother, Mircea, were murdered after the Hungarians invaded Valachia. In response, the Sultan sent the imperial army to meet them and foolishly allowed Vlad to ride in the vanguard after he begged to avenge his father's death. But it was all a ruse, and after crossing the border into Wallachia, Vlad disappeared. You're not sure what happened to this Vlad Dracula after he escaped the custody of the Sultan. All you know is that he reappeared in Wallachia at the head of a Hungarian-backed invasion force in 1456. He kicked out the puppet ruler the Sultan had installed, then went about purging all of his enemies, which included a small group of Saxon settlers who happened to offend him by taking back the goods some Valachian merchant had bought from them. It was daylight robbery, a high offense for sure, but to respond the way this Vlad Dracula did was just inhuman. You remember hearing about how some Balkan madman who impaled men and women on stakes, then burned their children in front of them while they were still alive. People said it took days for them to die, that whatever psycho was responsible had a way of impaling you as not to pierce any vital internal organs. That way, you'd die of the pain, or the thirst, or the exposure before you ever died of blood loss. Then there was the rumor you heard. At least, you pray it's just a rumor. That Dracula had a huge copper cauldron built, one with a huge wooden lid with human neck-sized holes cut into it. He'd then fill it with water, secure a couple of his enemies in there by the necks, then light a huge fire underneath. That way, he could watch as they felt the water getting hotter and hotter, watch as they begged, watch as they cried, watch as they screamed and screamed and screamed in agony. And then he could watch as they died. Then there was the stuff about him impaling people. He seemed obsessed with impaling people. What is wrong with a person when they're so fixated on something like that? We even heard he impaled pregnant women in a way that they... But, by God, that doesn't bear thinking about. All you want to think about now is getting back to Turkey, back to your family and your fields, back home. Many years go by. You survive another campaign with the Kapakulu, the Imperial Army, but that one will prove to be your last. You take an arrow in the knee, some lucky shot by a rebellious Greek, and your adventuring days are over. You retire to your farm, to your wife, to your children, and for the first time in many, many years, you are content. One day you're browsing plowshares in the local marketplace when you hear news from the northwestern frontier of the empire. Valachia is once again independent, and has been for a few years now. The Turks leave Dracula B, and in turn, he leaves the borders untouched. You hear that as a show of respect, the Sultan sent two emissaries to convey his respects to the son of the dragon. Dracula told them they must take off their headwear when in his presence. The emissaries replied that their turbans denote that they are Sayyids, descended from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and that they would have to respectfully refuse to remove them. Dracula was said to have respected their custom in his own special way by having their turbans nailed to their skulls with three iron bolts. They were reportedly still alive when Dracula sent them back to Turkey on horseback. They were discovered a week later, carrion crows picking at their rotting corpses, which had in fact been tied to the horses. It's stories like that which made you glad you got out of the Kapakulu while you still had the breath in your lungs. Men like Dracula remind you that the Semum, the Djinn, the demons, they sometimes take human form. And that no matter how much time goes by, no matter how much Dracula's legend gets twisted and embellished, he was real, very real. And once, you almost met him. Born in 1404 as Gilles de Montmorency Lavelle in Brittany, France, the young Gilles would grow up to inherit his father's title as the Baron de Rais. More commonly known as Gilles de Rais, he was once a respected chevalier, what the French called their knights, and rose to prominence as none other than Joan of Arc's military chief of staff. His was a sort of celebrated career, at least until some profoundly disturbing proclivities were discovered. Soon, a web of lies, deceit, and predatory murder was unwoven, until it was clear that Gilles de Rais was one of the most monstrous individuals to have ever walked the earth. The family that Gilles belonged to was the core of House Montmorency, one of the oldest, most respected, and most distinguished aristocratic houses in France at that time. From an early age, Gilles seemed to live up to the high expectations his family had for him. By his teenage years, he had distinguished himself militarily during the Wars of Secession that had been the bane of the Duchy of Brittany. He also gained additional honor by fighting at the Battle of Anjou, fighting for his duchess against France's historic enemy, the English, in 1427. By the time Joan of Arc emerged on the scene in 1429 to challenge the pesky English, Gilles de Rais was already one of France's most celebrated generals. The citizenry didn't care about how young he was. He won battles, and that was all that mattered to them. As a result of his esteem and martial prowess, Gilles was assigned to Joan of Arc as one of her personal bodyguards and fought at her side in several battles. He particularly distinguished himself in her arguably greatest victory, the breaking of the English siege at Orleans. He then accompanied her to Reims for the coronation of King Charles VII, who made Gilles de Rais Marshal of France, a distinction awarded to generals for exceptional achievement. Gilles was also exceptionally wealthy. Not only had he inherited significant land holdings and estates from both his father and maternal grandfather, he married a rich heiress, a match which brought him even more extensive holdings and made him one of France's richest men. He was so rich that he could afford to retire from military life in 1434, at the age of just 30. But it soon became clear that Gilles was not clearly as good at managing his finances as he was at commanding soldiers in wartime, and it didn't take him long to squander his mountains of riches with an expensive taste that rivaled that of the country's monarch. Within just 18 months of his retirement, Gilles had been forced to sell off most of his extensive estate, and his worried family members rushed to secure a decree from the king which forbid him from piddling away what was left. Then, in a bizarre and misguided attempt to recoup his holdings, Gilles turned to alchemy, hoping to discover a way in which to turn common-based metals into the most precious of metals, gold. But that's not all. Gilles also turned to Satanism, hoping to gain knowledge, power, and riches by summoning the devil himself. Shocking as that may be, the Satanism was just a small and benign component of Gilles' great and malevolent evil. As it turned out, he had a taste for the torture, carnal violation, and murder of children. In 1440, it was clear that an increasingly erratic Gilles was losing his mind. One day, he got into a dispute with local church figures, and the disagreement escalated until Gilles ended up kidnapping a local priest. Such a reckless act against a man of God triggered a general ecclesiastical investigation of Gilles, which in turn unearthed some frankly horrifying things. It turned out that the once celebrated general had been murdering children, mostly boys but also the occasional girl, by the hundreds. His method of choice was to lure children from peasant or lower class families to his grand countryside chateau by offering them gifts such as candies, toys, or clothing, things they would have been otherwise unable to afford. His fame, kind demeanor, and generous treatment would quickly put his young victims at their ease. He would then continue to feed and pamper them, before finally leading them to a bedroom where Gilles and accomplices would seize their victims. As he confessed in a subsequent trial, Gilles got a sadistic kick out of watching their fear, and he explained what was in store for the kid. and what was in store was none too good. Suffice to say that it involved torture and ended with the children's murder, usually via decapitation. The victims and their clothing were then burned in the fireplace and their ashes dumped in a moat. After Gilles confessed to his crimes, he and his accomplices were condemned to death. He was executed on October 26, 1440, by burning and hanging simultaneously. Gilles was so infamous that his story would go on to inspire the fairy tale of Bluebeard, a tale of a wealthy serial wife killer who was as charming as he was depraved. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial. And you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations for just $1 a month on Patreon, and maybe even pick up some Let's Read merch on Spreadshirt. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all these stories in long compilation form and save huge on data. Located anywhere you listen to podcasts. Links in the bio. Thanks so much, friends, and I'll see you again soon.